From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a teacher is fired from a Catholic all-girls high school. Barb Webb is pregnant, she is gay, and she reacts to her supporters and her critics.
One of my fears is what kind of outlet the LGBT students might have.
Michigan Congressman Dan Kildee speaks out against an underground nuclear waste storage facility being considered in Ontario.
This is something that, to me, gets to the fundamental question of stewardship of our most precious resource, that being the Great Lakes.
And what can we all learn from the celebrity nude selfie hack? Plenty.
Certainly would have been better if security and privacy had been better understood and baked into the original design, but it's a bit late. The horse is out of the barn.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Should nuclear waste be stored less than a mile from Lake Huron? I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, Canadian officials are holding a public hearing on whether Ontario Power Generation should be allowed to build an underground nuclear storage facility. More on that later this hour. But first, the firing of a pregnant teacher at Marion High School in Bloomfield Hills is making headlines across the country and actually internationally. For 9 years, Barb Webb taught chemistry and coached various teams at the all-girls Catholic school. Webb is a lesbian. She married her wife, Kristen, 2 years ago. Earlier this year, they found out they were expecting a baby. Barb Webb's firing has ignited an emotional response on social media. Many Marion alumni, parents, supporters spoke out in support of Webb on a Facebook page that now has over 4,000 members. Other sites, however, people write there are those who believe that she violated the teachings of the Catholic Church, and as such, the Catholic private school was well within its rights to fire her. A quick disclaimer here. My daughter and my daughter-in-law are both graduates of Marion High School, although neither ever had Barb Webb as a teacher. Barb Webb, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Barb, tell us what happened in August when you were fired by school administrators. What were you told?
Well, that meeting was actually quite brief. We had a meeting prior to that was a little bit more lengthy. But the second meeting where I was actually fired, I was basically told that there were no options for me in terms of a leave of absence, whether it be medical or an educational leave, and that really my only options were to resign or be terminated. And that's, again, after having met with administrator prior to that who, we discussed possible options and, you know, brainstormed some things. And really when I left that first meeting, she left me feeling like, you know, she was going to look for a way to keep me at Marion and that she just wasn't sure what that was going to look like. And then 3 weeks later, the tides had definitely shifted.
Did that surprise you?
You know, I would say that if I went into that first meeting and, you know, disclosed what I disclosed, and that was the result after that first meeting, I would have been less surprised than the second meeting. And that's primarily because of the response I got at the first meeting. I really felt some sympathy during that first meeting.
And you chose to let them fire you. And why was that?
Well, I mean, the resignation had a few stipulations to it. It did ask that I didn't speak to anyone about the details of the resignation at all, and it would have provided me with health care through this academic year, so that would have been early June. It also came with saying the administrators would give me a letter of recommendation, which to me implied that if they terminated me, they're going to forbid their administrators from giving me any type of letter of recommendation, and obviously I wouldn't have the health care. And I just thought that it doesn't really matter what they offered me. I suppose that I had to share with people just what happened. You know, for good or for bad, for agreeing or for disagreeing, I think people needed to know that, hey, you know, this type of thing exists and it exists today.
Barb, Marion's teacher contract contains a morality clause. And does it not state teachers will not publicly engage in actions or endorse actions or beliefs contrary to the teachings of the Catholic faith?
That's true, and it does say that. And, you know, I would emphasize the public portion because at least in practice, that seemed to be the way that the administration enforced that clause.
Barb, there are those who are asking, you know, it's no secret that Catholic teaching does not condone an LGBT lifestyle. So why teach at a school that is basically opposed to your sexual orientation, to who you really are?
And that's a valid question, and I think it's, you know, worthy of some discussion. And it's definitely not a one-point answer. I mean, I think there's a couple of components to that. As far as the being public and being pregnant, you know, I acknowledge that, and that's why I proactively went to the administration and said, you know, this is my scenario. I love this school. I'm happy to negotiate ways that we might be able to work collectively such that this doesn't become public. And, you know, that was my hope going in there. I knew that there was a possibility that they might not be willing, and ultimately that's what happened. But, you know, I went in there in hopes to remain discreet about it and not, you know, make it a public thing or flaunt it in anyone's face. The other part of the question of why I would even choose to teach there to begin with, I mean, that goes back a decade. And if I can remember my state of mind almost 10 years ago, I do remember when I applied for the position, you know, being a little anxious. You know, this was a Catholic school and, you know, chemistry teaching position. I am a public school student, so I never went to Catholic school. So admittedly, I really wasn't sure what role a non-theology teacher had in a Catholic classroom. And so I went right into that first interview, and I dissected the Marian mission statement, and I was very honest with the person who interviewed me and said, you know, this is where I think I might be a strength for you. This is where I think I might be a weakness for you. And I said, you know, the fact that this is a Catholic school, I have to be honest, I don't really know what that looks like. You know, what are the responsibilities and expectations on me as a professional being that this is Catholic? And at that time, you know, I was told that really that translates to, you know, being okay with a daily prayer, participating in things like donations and charities and all of these things that I was 100% behind. As far as the actual church, my expectation was to walk my homeroom to the church and basically monitor attendance. So to me, that really didn't have a huge Catholic role teaching chemistry. The other thing I was told was, you know, Marian employs you know, teachers from the far right to the far left and every shade in the middle. In fact, you don't even have to be Catholic to work there. So again, that kind of made me feel like, well, you know, maybe you can enjoy your life and have a private home and not interfere with what your public employment might look like.
And you shared the news of your firing in a Facebook post in late August. And in that posting, you wrote about the concerns you have, particularly for the LGBT students at Marian. What do you think your firing says to them?
You know, one of my fears that I've had is what kind of outlet the LGBT students might have or not have. And, you know, I think that fear was realized when I've gotten private messages and messages posted publicly on Facebook, you know, telling me about their experiences that they had at the school. And, you know, it just really, it affects me because I think that these kids, even these young adults, even after they graduate, need an outlet. They need someone to talk to and help them through this process because you can't just ignore it. And to me, not having an outlet like that is almost a slight form of neglect for the kids. You know, you can't pretend it's not there and brush it under the rug. Obviously, I have had dozens upon dozens of private messages from students who've told me that this is the case and, you know, validated that fear for me. So seeing that, you know, has really struck me to make this not about me and my particular situation, but to make it about a discussion about what's best for students and what students might need.
Now, have you found another teaching job?
I am doing a little bit of subbing, but nothing full time right now. You know, taking a little time to catch my breath and to, you know, focus on family. But that is something that I, you know, will look for and hope to get in the near future.
If Marian asked you to come back and offered you your job back, would you take it?
That's a great question. I think I'd need to know a little bit more about that. But if it was a sincere offer, if it was something where, you know, I would be accepted for who I am, I definitely would take it because there's so many aspects about the school that are wonderful, and that's why I stayed there so long. You know, I could be making, I looked it up online, I could be making $20,000 more a year with my education and experience in a public school, but I didn't leave. So, you know, I would definitely consider it if it was an environment that was safe for me and, you know, safe for the students around me.
Barbara Webb, thank you so much for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Stateside offered Marion High School administrators an opportunity to speak on this program. A school spokesperson told me that because this is an employee-employer matter, they're not prepared to comment further. She did admit this is, and I quote, a very difficult, challenging time. She says the school is aware of, again her words, impassioned voices, and she says they wish Barbara Webb well. A big piece of Detroit's bankruptcy puzzle was put into place today, the newly created Great Lakes Water Authority, as the city finally came to an agreement with Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties to create a regional water authority, an authority that provides water to some 40% of Michiganders. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick is here with more. Let's go right to the wallet, Sarah. What will this mean in terms of water rates for some 4 million customers?
Basically, what this agreement outlines is it says that rate increases will be limited to no more than 4% a year over 10 years. That doesn't necessarily mean that that will be the cap of the rates for all communities, since different communities set their own water rates and tack on different surcharges and so forth. So how much more you'll actually be spending depends on where you live. And they've actually brought in a private consultant, a French water company called Veolia, to review this and make sure that those rate assumptions of 4% a year are feasible. And it does say that if the review shows that that can't happen, that any of the parties have a right to back out of the deal.
And Sarah, what comes next? What makes this all happen?
So it's supposed to be approved by October 10th, and the boards of commissioners of Macomb, Oakland, and Wayne County, and as well as the city of Detroit, have until then to basically approve it. So what happens is if at least two of those bodies do approve the deal by October 10th, then basically the Great Lakes Water Authority is just going to be created on its own, and this whole deal will go into effect. So basically they need two of those to do so, and if the other two either don't act or sort of vote this down, the governor can step in and appoint a representative for them in their stead. So really, two of these parties need to agree to this deal by October 10th.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick checking in with the latest on the newly created Great Lakes Water Authority. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Put away your smartphone and your tablets. Talk face-to-face. Play some board games. Connect with one another. That's the message from 3 and Up Lounge in Plymouth. Angela Space is co-founder of the lounge. Angela, how'd you come up with this idea?
My husband and I visited a board game cafe in Toronto, and board game cafes exist in many other countries in the world and are quite popular, and they haven't really sprung up in the United States. Part of it might be our technology base. Part of it might be just people's different priorities. And so we thought, this is a really cool, great idea, but we didn't want to run a cafe. We didn't want to run a bar. We wanted to have people and then connect them via games. So we've morphed this idea of a board game cafe where you sell sandwiches and grilled cheese and coffee and really turned it more into a lounge where people first and foremost connect with each other. Secondary is the games and the idea of playing together and having fun and laughing and learning.
And the whole idea is, let's make this technology free and let's actually look each other in the face and connect?
Yes, we think people are important, and we've gotten away from that. I spend a lot of time on my phone in front of a computer. My kids are asking for tablets for Christmas. You know, everybody has the same, I wouldn't call it a problem, but phenomenon, right? That we are technology based. And so my husband said, okay, let's take this idea of a community center a step further and use games as the medium for the communication and for the connection. From there, it kind of blossomed, and people have been really great accepting our quirky, electronic-free game environment.
And in fact, I would suspect for some it's almost a relief. I can put it away. They're making me put it away, so I don't have to be checking work emails.
Yeah, it's almost – it's kind of funny because people are a little skeptical, I'd say, when they walk in the door, and they say, we really have to put our phone away? And we said, yes, we'd like you to. We have some funny ways of convincing people to put it away. We have an anti-Wi-Fi zone. We let people boo each other. In fact, if they're texting. Of course, there's some common sense rules. I just told my doctor friend, it's okay if you have your phone on because you're saving lives. Pregnant women allowed to have their phones on. It's not a strong hand rule, but it is a suggestion, and we really enjoy watching people put it away and then kind of forgetting about the time, forgetting about the news feed, and spending time with each other.
And what kind of effect are you hoping the 3 and Up Lounge will have on the Plymouth area?
Plymouth has such a vibrant nature, and we have added something quite quirky to that. There are restaurants, there are yogurt places, there are salons, and there are a few things to do, we say. We're a thing to do. We're an experience. And there are a few of those in Plymouth, but we're hoping to become a place where when you are heading to dinner in Plymouth or you're heading to grab a cocktail with a friend, you'll say, hey, we can go by the Board Game Lounge for an hour and a half, hang around, and then head to dinner. And really be able to talk to each other and laugh and spend time with each other in sort of that one-on-one or maybe group setting.
The 3 and Up Lounge is on South Main Street in Plymouth. Angela, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
During the summertime, music festivals take over forests and fields all across the state. You'll usually hear the sounds of banjos, guitars, maybe even some mandolins. Green Sky Bluegrass is very familiar to Michigan's music scene. But the Kalamazoo-based band is also gaining national attention. Stateside's Emily Fox recently sat down with two members of the band.
As the summer music festival season draws to a close, Green Sky Bluegrass is about to embark on a big tour.
There's a secret in the basement, I can feel it through the floor. I don't think this heart can take the weight of deception anymore. Cry out in helpless agony for the broken memories and things I thought that I would never be. Oh.
We're listening to Windshield. It's the single off of their latest album, If Sorrows Swim, which is being released today. I'm now joined by mandolin player Paul Hoffman, who wrote and sings on that track. I'm also joined by dobro player Anders Beck. And Anders, just so everyone's up to speed, can you describe what a dobro looks like, and can you play a little lick for us?
It looks like a guitar with a hubcap in it, for lack of a better description. And you play it flat, like a lap steel or a pedal steel, which maybe you don't know what that is either. Anyway, it sounds like this is probably a better way to describe it.
Lovely. Like and so Paul, so everything's good and fair. Can you play a little mandolin for us?
I would love to.
So, a lot of tune.
So, Paul, I understand that This American Life actually gave a little inspiration for this album. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, the title track, If Sorrows Swim. I was on a real big kick when I was still driving the bus more often and listening to This American Life a lot.
It's This American Life from Ira Glass.
Somewhere in the interview, there was discussion of, like, you know, what if we can't drown our sorrows?
I thought I could drown all my sorrows, but then I figure out that my sorrows could swim.
And it just occurred to me as a very prolific thing. And, you know, isolated as the album title, just If Sorrows Swim, it sort of like it leaves the answer unknown. It's like, what if sorrows swim? And then it's for you to decide what the answer might be.
I want to be a bad guy in a silent film, lit up by candles in the space between the shadows. I wouldn't have to say nothing or sound mean. I just wouldn't smile or look too. They can all be good. My guess bet that they shouldn't. What if sorrows swim? Good God, gonna need to burn them.
So my favorite part about watching bluegrass music is when you kind of let loose and improvise. It's kind of a musical conversation. You're listening to one person and then you kind of respond. And, you know, it's all in the moment, no notation, which I think is beautiful. So, Anders, describe what that feels like when you're on stage and it's your turn to improvise.
Well, first off, that's one of the things that I love about the music as well and what really drew me to it. You know, it's a player's music in a lot of ways, where you can you can play what you want, and everybody does that, and that's what's really cool about bluegrass as a genre, in my opinion, as well. So I think you're on to something there. While we're talking about improvising, that I play music with four other people that are totally willing to follow me down the wormhole musically. You know, if I get some weird idea and start playing it, they're all coming with me, and that's what it is for all of us. So it is a pretty amazing feeling.
And what does it feel like for you when you're on stage and it's your turn to improvise, Paul?
It's amazing. I'm so grateful that we get to do it. You know, and it's exciting because we've accepted and we embrace that our material can change and be different. And, you know, a song can take on the mood of the show. Recently, that song I was just mentioning, All Four, it's got a big open section and it gets real small and it's very dynamic. It's and very emotional. And when we were recently playing at Red Rocks, I reminded myself to take a deep breath before I started my solo and to look around me and be grateful that playing the mandolin and writing songs had brought me to such a beautiful place to play for 9,000 people. And, you know, I just looked up and the sun was setting and the clouds were all pink, and I think I played a beautiful solo. I remember really, really enjoying it and being proud of myself for not being so caught up in the moment that I didn't stop and appreciate how awesome it was.
I forgot about the five of us and what we came here for.
So Paul, Rolling Stone recently wrote that Green Sky Bluegrass is representing the genre for a whole new generation. Why do you think that is?
I think it's because, you know, young people, people who don't normally listen to bluegrass music are coming out and they're enjoying our band, and we're able to provide something or, you know, play music that is in one moment very much bluegrass and in one moment very much not. And that attracts people that might not know they liked bluegrass. I was one of those people until I discovered David Grisman and then met the guys in the band. And then I discovered Bill Monroe and Ralph Stanley, and I was surprised that I liked this high, lonesome country music that was recorded on crappy microphones. So I think, you know, for us to bring in people, because we play long improvised rock music, and then for them to discover they also really love the bluegrass is why that would be said, I believe.
Mm-hmm. And Paul, you're the mandolin player as well as a singer and songwriter for Green Sky Bluegrass. And you've said before that your sound isn't just bluegrass. And, you know, while you have the right instruments for the fit, that it's almost kind of like a rock band. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
I think that Green Sky is very much a bluegrass band. And we spend a lot of time sort of defining ourselves as not that, to prove that we were capable of more. And I think that we're also very much a rock and roll band. And a lot of that is maybe more of an attitude or an approach to the music. It's about the way that we get on stage and the way that we perform. And we have a light show and we're willing to take these risks and we cuss. And, you know, I can't write bluegrass songs about the Blue Ridge Mountain or being a coal miner because they would just be contrived, and we're trying to make something that's real to us. And, you know, we didn't grow up playing bluegrass that way.
And now you tour across the country and have played at some big name festivals like Bonnaroo and Electric Forest. But in August, you were the headlining band at Hoxieville, and that's a music festival in between Manistee and Cadillac. And other Michigan bands that were there were Lindsay Lou and the Flat Bellies, Steppin' In It, Seth and May, and Root Stand, and that's just to name a few. So despite your national recognition, how close are you to the music scene here in Michigan? And I'll leave that up to, you know, either one of you to answer.
Incredibly close, I think. We, all those people are dear friends of ours, every single person you mentioned there. We play songs by Josh Davis and Steppin' In It. We play those songs all over the country because we love those songs. You know, there's a couple of Josh Davis songs that we play, and people think that they're ours. And we try really hard to inform them that they're not ours, you know, because we want to spread the love a little bit for all of our friends. You know, Michigan has an amazing music scene, and we're lucky to be a part of it.
What's your favorite song on this album, If Sorrow Swim?
My favorite recording on the album is In Control. That's the one I listen to and I'm really proud of. the recording itself. I like a lot of the songs for different reasons. Of course, you know, being the songwriter, I understand them on a pretty profound level. But that song's pretty interesting because I wrote it almost 5 years ago, and the band played it for a hot minute and then decided it wasn't really working, and so we abandoned it for a lot of years. And when we started talking about recording this record, we decided to play it again. It's been really fun.
That's right, we tried to play the...
We played it for a while.
We tried to play it a bunch, and we couldn't figure out what it was supposed to be. That was a real pain in the butt.
Well, I'm glad you brought it back, because I remember when I listened to it the first time, and something about the slowness of it, it really seems nostalgic to me.
Will you ride beside me now, or ever frightened all the words away? Not out of
Bluegrass has been around for 14 years. What would you say is a secret for being able to play together for so long and live on the road for so long?
If I told you, it wouldn't be a secret. It's always my answer.
Michigan Radio exclusive.
That's right.
Exclusive. Today only. You know, there's a lot of funny answers to that. Like, don't succeed for the first 6 years and then you got to keep trying. That's one. But, we all are great friends, and, you know, as Andre just mentioned when we were talking about improvising, we musically seem to have a lot of the same goals and ambitions for what the band is capable of, and, you know, we have that same joy for playing simple, straight-ahead, you know, rowdy bluegrass and also very ambient, psychedelic something else. It's really rewarding for us still. You know, I remember when we toured early on in 2004 and 5 when we were playing bars and sleeping in tents, and we were working so hard, going to a campground and setting up a tent and then going to a bar and playing a show and then going back to the campground and then striking our tents at 8 in the morning to drive to the next town that we were going to play another bar at that no one was going to come to, and we were going to be lucky if we made $100 and hopefully we would get free dinner and maybe some free drinks. And I remember how fun it was back then and exciting to see the country and to be out on a whim of our creative ambition. And some of that has changed, and the way it's changed is, you know, like the traveling the country is still exciting, but playing the music is so exciting and our fans are so excited about the music that just continuously blows my mind that people really enjoy what we do, and we do too. And boy, that's such a cyclical thing that's just gorgeous to be a part of. That's why we stay together, because it's fun and it's rewarding.
So if you could describe your latest album, If Sorrow Swim, this is your fifth studio album, in one word, what would it be?
I say mixtape because, you know, where Dark Side of the Moon is this brilliant concept album that flows all the way through. I don't think that this album is not cohesive, because a mixtape, good mixtape is cohesive, but I really feel like this album is a great cross examination of a lot of different things that Green Sky is capable of musically. There's like rockin' on the downbeat tunes, there's bouncy tunes, there's these ballads that are real dramatic and everything in between. So I've always kind of viewed this album as the Green Sky mixtape.
I've been speaking with Paul Hoffman. He's the mandolin player as well as a vocalist and songwriter for Green Sky Bluegrass. I was also joined by Anders Beck. He's the dobro player for Green Sky Bluegrass. Their fifth studio album, If Sorrow Swim, was released today. For more information, you can go to greenskybluegrass.com. Paul and Anders, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Canadian officials are holding a public hearing today looking at plans and listening to comments for a nuclear waste storage facility less than a mile from Lake Huron in the Ontario town of Kincardine. We've talked about this here on Stateside. Ontario Power Generation wants to build this underground storage facility. The Canadian panel will be hearing from the public. Michigan Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee is against this facility. Congressman, you've drawn up a resolution about the matter. What does it say?
Well, my resolution would express a sense of Congress asking that our government work with the Canadian government to identify other more appropriate, less environmentally sensitive sites, just as the Canadians did many years ago. That's an interesting sort of part of the history of this question, is that the shoe was on the other foot back in the 1980s when we were looking at nuclear waste storage facilities. We're simply asking that the Canadian government, the Ontario Power Generation folks, give us the same consideration that we did back, you know, over 30 years ago.
What has been, now, have you had a chance to introduce your resolution?
Yes, I introduced it yesterday.
And in talks with your colleagues, what kind of reception are you getting?
Well, for the most part, it's very positive. I have not had any negative response. Congressman Levin joined me in being original sponsors of the resolution, but I have had many other staff and members talk to my staff over the last 24 hours about this, and I've been in conversation with a good number of members. The hope is that we get good bipartisan support for this resolution. Simply the fact of introducing it, I think, does send a message to the Canadian government that the members of Congress are serious about this question, but obviously it would be much more powerful if we were able to get support for this resolution as we move forward. I will admit, it's a difficult process and a very tall hill to climb in a Congress that, frankly, can't come to unanimous consent to support the morning prayer, let alone something that is of substantive value, but we're going to try.
And as you say, you're sending the message by at least introducing it. I'm wondering, since this story has been developing when we first got word of OPG's plans, have you been able to have conversations with policymakers in Ottawa?
We have. In fact, just last week, I think after the announcement that we made on the shores of Lake Huron, we've had additional discussion with Canadian government representatives, and we have had ongoing discussions with them. And I will say it's been very civil. It's been cordial. It's not been confrontational. The Canadian government and the Canadian people are our friends and our allies. But just as is the case within a government, there are differences of opinion between governments that are friends. And this is one that I think is a pretty strong one for me. This is something that, to me, gets to the fundamental question of stewardship of our most precious resource, that being the Great Lakes. And the idea that 25, 50, or 100 years from now, the writers of history would look back on this moment after something disastrous occurred and wonder where their elected leaders were is just something that I can't sit and let pass.
Do you believe, Congressman, knowing that the public hearing opens today, that the public truly does have a voice? Is it truly a place for concerned citizens to make a statement that will have an impact, or do you fear it's window dressing?
Well, I hope it does, and my presumption is that these hearings are held with a genuine interest in hearing public input. They've had previous hearings and periods for comment. This is an additional period for comment. I do know that the Canadian government and the Canadian people are very concerned about the long-term relationship and the long-standing, very positive relationship that we've had between these two nations. And if it is possible that they would make a decision that would be just as convenient for them to locate the facility elsewhere without potentially causing some heartburn here in the United States and potentially long-term some real risk, I would hope that they would consider that. So we're looking at this as an opportunity for cordial but firm input and hope that they take it seriously.
Congressman Dan Kildee, Democrat from Michigan's 5th District. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Congressman.
Thank you very much.
Well, by now we've all pretty much heard about the hacking scandal that left naked photos of dozens of celebrities spilling out over the internet. Among them, Michigan-born supermodel Kate Upton and her boyfriend Justin Verlander of the Detroit Tigers. Just more proof, it seems, that nothing's safe when it comes to storing our files on the cloud. Kevin Fu is an associate professor in computer science and engineering at the University of Michigan, and he's a nationally recognized computer security expert. Kevin, did this iCloud celebrity hacking story surprise you at all?
Well, there are a lot of nuances to this story. It doesn't surprise me to hear about incidents of privacy problems. Usually these kinds of problems are thought about only after there's a crisis, unfortunately.
So this has got us all talking about it. And I think a lot of people are asking the question, what is the cloud and how secure is it? So can you kind of give us the ABCs?
I think nobody really knows what the cloud is. The cloud is this friendly term that describes basically everything about the computing that's outside of your local computer. But the boundaries are not too clear. Who runs the system are not too clear. But that's also the beauty of it. You don't have to worry about it. But at the same time, you don't know who's got your back. I was once told that if it were instead called swamp computing, we might have very different impressions of what it was. Nevertheless, we have cloud computing. It enables us to communicate in new ways, but it comes with these security and privacy risks.
Indeed. I guess, Kevin, what do most of us not realize when we take those photos on our smartphone and then it automatically syncs up? Say, in my case, my iPhone will sync up and it talks to my iPad and it's all up there in the cloud. But what do we not realize about moving and storing and deleting files like that?
There really is no delete button on the internet. And it takes a little bit of getting used to become accustomed to that. So although you might delete something on your phone, well, there are copies all over the place. Deletion is really hard. When you're using the cloud, when you're using social networking, one doesn't always realize that these boundaries don't really exist.
They don't exist. Even all those little things we check and those things we agree to when we decide that, you know, the cloud services terms, despite all of that, the boundaries don't exist.
Well, there are boundaries, but boundaries are seem to be always broken. And if you take a look at the typical terms of service for most of the popular cloud services, they're, in my opinion, very much in the favor of the cloud provider. What you can and cannot do with your data, and giving the cloud provider the ability to do quite a bit with your information. I'm not aware of too many people clamoring about how the terms of service are protecting the security and privacy of the consumer. It may in some cases, but I don't think that's going to be the real solution. The real solution is that these systems really need to have security and privacy baked in from the beginning, designed into the system. And what we're seeing are the repercussions of decades of sort of forgetting about solving the security and privacy problem. And suddenly we realize, you know what, it's not as there as much as we had hoped.
And then considering all of this, why should anyone have confidence, for example, in online banking transactions or online purchases?
Right. In the U.S., fortunately, the U.S. consumers relative to consumers, say, in the U.K., have stronger rights when it comes to things like fraud. For instance, if someone breaks into an account, there are certain defaults of who's at fault and who has to pay. In other countries, it's not always quite so nice. It does take quite a lot of time for the consumer to clean up a mess if your bank account, for instance, gets compromised. But it's a little different from privacy, where it's harder to assign a price tag.
So as we talk about this celeb nude selfie episode, I guess the one thing I think we need to understand is this isn't just celebs. I was trying to dig into this story a little bit and understand what is this 4chan, where this came from. And I stumbled on some screen grabs of conversations these hackers are having. They're trading everybody's pictures. They're hacking in, and they spell out how they do it and how proud they are. And it isn't the Kate Uptons and the famous people. It's just people that post, nudie pictures up on the cloud.
Yeah, well, there are a couple observations there. Perhaps before chatting about that, there's the whole question of this particular cloud service, the iCloud.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a look at the response from the manufacturer, it's a pretty standard response. I would summarize the response as sort of our systems were not compromised. And yet to the consumer, one realizes, well, wait a minute, how can it be that the manufacturer claims the system wasn't compromised, yet these people feel their privacy has been invaded? And all the facts are not quite clear yet, but what seems to be coming about is that it appears to be that some passwords were guessed and some of these personal forgot your password kind of questions were guessable. And there's quite a bit of research actually showing that these systems are just extremely difficult to keep secure. With that said, it's really not clear what would have been a better way to protect the system. It certainly would have been better if security and privacy had been better understood and baked into the original design, but it's a bit late. The horse is out of the barn.
So it sounds like it's on us, all of us, to decide what gets sent up into the cloud. And if we want to keep our private pictures private, then you don't put them up in the cloud.
That's right. Ultimately, the choice is, what do you put up there? Although there are certainly instances where people have had information posted by accident, There are cases of webcams being compromised, for instance, and in those cases, the person may not have intended to have their picture up there.
And there it is. So what are the most important things, Kevin, we could each do to make our stored data more secure?
To make our stored data more secure, we should be demanding better in security and privacy from the get-go. But the challenge is that we as individuals haven't yet found a way to bring our voices together to demand that better security and privacy.
It kind of doesn't sound like there's much of an answer to that, is there?
Well, it is, you know, a divide and conquer to some extent. So until we individuals get together and find some kind of consensus and prioritize for security and privacy, it's unlikely the industry is going to put as much effort as I would hope into it. For good reason. This is a capitalist country, so if nobody's willing to pay for security, then they're probably not going to deploy it. So one of the first things we need to come to realize is that security and privacy is not free. And then the second question is, are we willing to pay for it and to fix it?
Hey, Kevin, do you store photos on a cloud?
I do have photos on the cloud.
Okay, so you feel confident enough, but clearly it's something we should always assume that all eyeballs anywhere could be on our photos.
They probably are.
Kevin Fu is a computer security expert. He's with the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at the University of Michigan. Kevin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
More and more of us are striving to go green in our everyday lives. But what about when we die? That's where so-called green burials come in. Marilyn Rush is a funeral guide and a green burial consultant. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Just what does it mean when we say green burial?
Green burial means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But basically, the concept is that people are wanting to go back to the earth naturally, like we used to do in the old days. So no expensive casket, no non-biodegradable materials, no cement grave liner, cement vault, and just being put in the earth.
So well, I'd say I came to you and I wanted some advice on how to have a green burial and a home funeral. What would that entail?
So the first thing that people need to know is that it's quite simple. The hard part is actually talking about it and finding people to support you because it's such a foreign concept and most people think it's either illegal or bad for the environment or unsafe or it gets into the drinking water or some concern like that. And there have been a lot of fears built up around that in the last few centuries, you know, when we used to have grave robbers and things like that. The way you're supposed to do it has changed, and but the way we used to do it is people cared for their own at home, and a day or two after they died, they buried them in the local cemetery, just putting them in the earth to go back to the earth, ash to ashes, dust to dust.
And there is nothing that
There's
harms
nothing
the environment.
Wrong with that. There's nothing bad for the environment about that. What's bad for the environment is embalming, which hurts the workers that are doing the embalming because of the fluids that are being used, and it's also if you learn about what it actually is, it's kind of a gruesome process for the body. So if you have any ideas about not wanting to treat the body that way, that's one thing to consider. And then people are buying expensive caskets made of precious woods, using toxic resins and all kinds of brass fittings and synthetic materials. And it's not in line with the way we're living our lives these days. You know, like you mentioned, we're trying to reduce, reuse, and recycle. And it's like, why are we doing that all our lives and then not making choices like that about the way we care for the body after we die?
So what happens with the body when it goes in? Is it wrapped in a shroud? Is it in a cardboard or what?
All of the above. You can put the body in the earth wrapped in a sheet or a blanket or a shroud that's specially made for the purpose. You can use a plain pine box, as people are familiar with. You can use a wicker basket, anything like that. And then you can just, you know, you don't have to dig a hole 6 feet deep. It doesn't have to be that deep. And you put the body in the ground and refill with dirt. And the body goes back to the earth to nurture the earth in a really healthy way.
Now, are green burials offered at all cemeteries or just
no.
select?
In no. In fact, there's only one in Washtenaw County that's currently offering the natural burial.
So that's where you need some advice with mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. Give us a typical story of someone you've worked with who wanted to make the choice. Why?
I'll tell you about a family who had a daughter that was sick all her life, and when she died at age 5, they wanted to take care of her body at home and have a green burial. Because that's what gave them meaning. That was something that they could control, given that they couldn't control what had happened to their daughter. So they were very involved in the process with the whole extended family. They laid her out at home, and they washed her body and cooled her body with dry ice and had her there at home for a couple of days. And then when it was time for the burial, well, first they went to the church, and they had an open casket and a mass, a funeral mass, and then they proceeded to the cemetery, and they went to the one in Waterford that was just starting at the time, and she was maybe the third green burial there. It's a beautiful big green burial section in that cemetery, and they were able to wrap her or put her in a wicker basket that they had specially ordered and put her in the ground and shovel the dirt in themselves afterwards and have a little graveside ceremony there. And it made the whole process so much more meaningful and special for them because they were doing just what they wanted to be doing, and it was comforting to them.
I saw a statement actually on the Green Burial Council website. We believe death can and should connect to life. And you really saw that happen with this family, didn't you?
Exactly. People who are helping families have natural burials are realizing that when the family can make more choices and have more involvement in the process, it's healing for them.
Marilyn Rush is a green burial and home funeral consultant. You can find out about upcoming green burial events on her website, which is afterdeathhomecare.com. That's afterdeathhomecare.com. Marilyn, good to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was directed today by Ellie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Michelle Hahn, Haley Hirschman, and Annie Norris. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.